you know, no one alive can always be an angel. When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
KBOO is a co-sponsor of the Double Mountain Brewery and Tap Room's Great Bottle Roundup and Street Party on Sunday, August 23rd in Hood River. To lower their environmental impact, Double Mountain is working to reuse their bottles. More information about participating in the bottle bring back may be found at their website, doublemountainbrewery.com. Jeff Allworth kicks things off at 11:15 for a talk and signing of his book, The Beer Bible. From noon to 6 p.m., there will be music provided by Left Coast Country, Green Neck Daredevils, and Mile Marker 6. People that bring back bottles for the Bottle Roundup have a chance to win prizes throughout the day. That's on Sunday, August 23rd in Hood River. More information is available on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the River Signal, followed at 8 p.m., by A Different Nature. At 10 p.m., it is Talking Earth, and at 11 p.m., it's Gremlin Time. Stay tuned for all that and more here at KBOO Portland, but first, here's the River Signal.
The River Signal.
Long down following 10 seconds of silence.
5 days in the sky.
This summer, three of us, Galen, Brian, and Reed, are traveling down the Mississippi on the Channel Princess, a 30-foot paddlewheel riverboat. As we go, we're meeting musicians and recording them on boats and riverbanks, and then weaving their music into a serialized radio story. We pull together every episode of The River Signal in just 7 days, all while moving downriver and trying not to sink the boat.
The River Signal is fiction, set in a sort of weird alternate reality. And the world of each episode is inspired by the music we hear and the people we meet. We chose fiction because we don't quite believe in true travel stories. And we hope that by writing an obviously fictional account of our trip, we'll show how subjective travel stories can be.
We begin this week just outside of St. Louis. We've anchored in a nice protected spot, but just behind us, the water rushes by, dragging with it small islands of driftwood and dislodged buoys. Our last morning in town, Beth and Kit come to visit. Pretty much as soon as Kit gets on the boat, his upright bass nearly falls into the river, but he takes it in stride, says that basses float just fine. It's Beth's birthday, and we celebrate by giving her a mango with a candle on top. Beth and Kit sit up on the bow, and between barge traffic and the industrial waterfront of St. Louis, they play into the afternoon. Their stories and music helped inspire this week's episode.
Being around water has really become a way for me to process life. Different ways the water can make you feel. Like, it can be really calm and peaceful. It can be really tumultuous and you feel like it's gonna pull you under at points.
Terrifying,
yeah.
Episode 12, The Caboose, featuring Beth Bambara. That's the secret to it, really. It sounds like everything. You can listen to static for hours and keep hearing something different. Like a bonfire, or a waterfall, or sizzling bacon. For a while, I was keeping track. to see if there was some pattern to it. Waterfall, bonfire, bonfire, waterfall, bacon. It's just static, though. Now that we're near the confluence, I expected we'd be picking something up, but it's still dead out there. That last storm seemed to have wiped out transmissions. I managed to get a message off to my parents before the signal disappeared, but I can't be sure if they've received it. I can feel us picking up speed. The water is faster here and hard to read. Controlling the Channel Princess is getting tricky. Sometimes you have to put all your weight onto the wheel to keep the rudder straight. Waterfall, bacon, bonfire, bacon. Waterfall. Definitely waterfall. I hear Reed calling. When I poke my head out, I see that he's pointing towards shore. There's a rocky ledge there with water running down its face. The envoy jumps on deck and says, "That's the swing. We're here." I look again and see that there's a knotted rope hanging from the tree on top of the ledge. "And there's the cave," the envoy yells. I don't have a clue what he's talking about. But when we get closer, I notice a small opening in the rocks just above the waterline. It might be a cave, but I'm not sure how he would have seen that. Without another word, Envoy Benson dives off into the water. Reed follows a moment later, like this is totally normal, just diving off the boat and swimming into a hole in the wall. I take a moment to set an anchor off the bow. Someone has to look after the boat. And then I launch off into the water. When we reach the rocks, I can see that there's some kind of opening underwater, leading back into the darkness. Blindly diving into an underwater cave seems like a terrible idea. Reed may be a strong swimmer, but the envoy and I just have variations of the doggy paddle. And who knows how far back this tunnel goes? But before I can say anything, the guys dive back down. So I take a deep breath, duck my head under, and kick my way into the dark water. Water is clearer than I expected. Colder, too. I can just make out bubbles up ahead where Reed is swimming. Underwater, I can hear all these strange pulses and groans. They seem to be coming from every direction, and it almost feels like the water is vibrating. From the boat, the opening in the wall looked small, but up close, it's huge. As I swim, I can barely see the bottom. I'm trying to get a handle on these noises and see if there's some logic to them. But the bit of my brain that craves order is overruled quickly by the bit of my brain that craves oxygen. I can see light ahead, and I'm kicking harder now, bubbles streaming out behind as my lungs start to empty. As I move towards the surface, I see a huge form through the murky water. It's a submarine, seemingly pieced together from scraps, but built around an old train car. We're in a large cavern. Light filters down from above, and I can see the top of the submarine. It's floating in the middle of the pool. Reed and the envoy are treading water nearby, catching their breath. It's quiet in here, and I can hear the muffled sound of music. After I get some oxygen back to my brain, I make the connection. This is the lost caboose the envoy was talking about. Somehow they've managed to build a submarine and they're broadcasting from it. But why? It seems awfully elaborate. The three of us swim over and look in one of the round portals. In a lit cabin, there are two musicians, a woman playing guitar and a guy with an upright bass that's nearly scraping the ceiling. We knock a few times to get their attention, but they don't hear us. So we wait for them to finish, treading water in the dark cavern and peering through the glowing orb of the portal.
Down here is thick and rank. We've only been in the caboose for a few minutes, but already I'm drenched in sweat. A single red light reveals the cluttered guts of the sub. A mess of pipes and wires snake overhead, linking an array of strange machines which blink and buzz in the darkness. It's tighter than a badger's den down here, and we nearly have to crawl to move about. Whatever madman built this boat clearly did not consider comfort a priority. When the people inside finished their song, they finally noticed us tapping on the glass. A moment later, they poked their heads out of the hatch. "We've been expecting you three," the woman said. "Anna's out exploring the caves, so you should come aboard until she returns." Now the two of them, Beth and Kit are their names, are guiding us towards the stern of the sub. When we reach the galley, Kit sets out a pile of matching orange coveralls, same as he and Beth are wearing. He points to the sizable puddle beneath us and says, "You're leaking." We slip out of our soggy clothes and into the coveralls. Mine fit all right and Huggins too, but the Envoys are about 8 sizes too big. "I bet you guys are curious about the caboose," she says. Beth leads us down a narrow corridor through a gauntlet of crisscross plumbing and conduit. At the end, there's a heavy door with a sign that reads, "Meat Locker." Beth gestures inside and says, "Welcome to the radio room." It's a small space, and the four of us just barely squeeze inside. In the center is a lit control panel. Beth sits in front of the panel and flips on the power. Electric current seems to flood the room, and I feel the hairs on my forearm stand on end. The caboose, Beth explains, has an extremely powerful transmitter. Whenever they surface, they can broadcast hundreds of miles up and down the river. Beth says that getting on the caboose was a dream come true. For years, she and Kit have been broadcasting out in the mudflats, singing ballads about herd movements and flash floods. But their little transmitter didn't reach very far, maybe 20 miles tops. And then one day, the howl swept in and knocked out their signal entirely. So when Anna showed up on the caboose and asked if they wanted to come on board, they said yes, and they've never looked back. Anna's been doing a pretty great thing here, gathering up all us broadcasters and giving us safe passage down to the Delta congregation. Suddenly, Hawkins appears very interested in this conversation. "What do you know about the congregation?" he asks. "Not much," she says. "Just that it'll be a big gathering of broadcasters, and we'll figure out how to get the signal back and what to do about these howling winds. Until then, we won't be servicing too much. Captain says we're to keep a low profile, maintain radio silence so we don't provoke the howl." "Who's the captain?" I ask. But Beth doesn't hear me. She's begun flipping switches and tweaking knobs. Little lights began flashing on the control board. "From here on out," Beth says, "we're only to broadcast via sonar." It's those weird, bubbly sounds again, but like the ones we heard while swimming through the cave. "Pretty cool, right?" Beth says. She explains that the caboose has a speaker capable of transmitting sound waves hundreds of miles through the river itself, and an ultra-sensitive microphone for receiving return signals. The captain uses this system to communicate with folks down in the Delta, but Beth and Kit, they just like listening to the fish. Beth looks to me and asks if I'd like to give it a whirl. I swap places with her, and she shows me how to rotate the underwater microphone and tune into different parts of the river. I can hear catfish grunting and otters chattering. I wish I had one of these when I was a kid. Now Huckins is asking Beth to see the inner workings of the sonar system, probably curious to see if he can whip up one of his own. Find another way to get in touch with his folks in the Delta. She leads him out of the radio room, and on her way out, she says, "I'll be right back." Well, I hope she doesn't hurry. I could play with this thing for hours. Let's see. If I spin this wheel, I can reorient the microphone. Huh. Northeast of here, it sounds like the bullfrogs are getting ready to spawn. And if I'm not mistaken, a couple gars are having at it off to the south. Is that what I think it is? I jerk up the volume, listening close. Rat, I lost it. Whatever it is, it sounds big. It must be moving fast. There it is again. I wonder if I can convince it to come closer. Boy, I'd love to snag that fish before the girl I met at the exchange does. My brother once told me that a good doe call is the best lure for a frisky buck. Maybe it works on fish too. I mess around with the controls for a minute before I figure out how I can record the sounds coming in and play them right back. One of the knobs up top controls the pitch, and I adjust it until it sounds a little bit more ladylike. It's not an exact science. I adjust the playback speed and then send it back out into the water. Thank you.
are 7 tunnels in the walls of this cave. Exactly 7. And I know because I've been sitting on top of the caboose for an hour staring at them. Ever since the day I met her in Superior Land, it's been like this. She gets my hopes up with a broadcast, a note, and now the caboose itself, but then she just up and disappears. So, even though Beth said she's out for a walk, I'm starting to wonder whether she exists. Huckins swam back to the princess to grab something. I don't know what, he never tells me anything. It sounds like Beth and Kit are playing music again, but Reed must still be in the radio room. He's making some weird noises down there. I wonder what he's doing, who he's trying to talk to. At first, I think I must be imagining those footsteps, but no, they're getting louder. I spin around trying to figure out which tunnel they're coming from, but it's so echoey in here. A figure emerges from the biggest tunnel. It's a woman. She's wearing a sort of jumpsuit and her hair's up, tucked into the band of her headlamp. But I can tell, it's her. I raise up a hand and I'm about to say her name, or what I think her name is, but before I can, she dives into the water. As she swims over, I try to compose myself and figure out something to say. But by the time she gets to the caboose, I've got nothing. So I just watch as she climbs the ladder. And now here she is, right in front of me. She's smiling, and I think I am too. Or I'm trying to. I hope it at least looks like a smile. Envoy, she says. I'm so glad you're here. It's good to be here, I managed to say. I really wasn't sure you'd make it, she says. And I am so sorry for being out of touch these past weeks. The howl's been getting terrible and we haven't been able to surface at all. Anyway, it really is good to see you. I've got so much to catch you up on and a lot of questions too. She's talking to me in this really familiar way, like we've known each other for years. It feels that way to me too, but I swear we just met that once in Superior Land. Now she starts to tell me about the caboose, what it is, where it's going. But I say I already know. Beth and Kit told me the whole plan about bringing broadcasters down to the Delta. At this, Anna frowns. Well, yeah, she says. Sort of. Before I can ask what that means, she smiles and says, I want to show you something. Then she picks up her jumpsuit, turns and heads down the hatch into the caboose. I follow Anna along a gangway over the engine room, then into her cabin. It's tiny but cozy. There's a nice wool blanket on the bed, and all sorts of rocks and sticks arranged on her dresser. The rocks are red and blue and perfectly smooth, just like the ones I used to collect from the shore of the Big Lake. I wonder where hers came from. I sit on the bunk as Anna rummages around in a desk drawer. It dawns on me that I still don't even know why she tracked me down, why she asked me to come all this way. Before I can ask, Anna yanks a tape from the drawer and says, found it. Anna puts the tape in the deck. She looks up and says, there's so much she wants to tell me, but she doesn't quite know where to start. So she's just going to play me something.
This is a second sister broadcasting to the Upper Underground. I don't have much time. I've heard reports of foremen in the area, but I wanted to tell you all that we're getting close. Josie says the western tunnels are within a quarter mile of the Upper Dome. Beth's crew in the eastern flats is making good progress toward the Big Lake bumper boats. And here in the 6th Department, we're right where we want to be, 20 feet under the lake homes. If we just keep stockpiling dynamite, by the end of the summer, we'll... Oh, geez, they're here. I've got to get back to my post, but I'll...
I stare at the radio long after Anna stops the tape. Finally, I say, "You're from Superior Land?" Anna nods. She says she grew up working the mines, spent all day dynamiting walls of fake ore, only to rebuild them at night when the visitors were asleep in their log fortresses. It was terrible work, especially because visitors rarely even came to watch. But over time, Anna realized this was a good thing. No visitors meant no foremen. So when she found an old transmitter in an abandoned mine, then ran a cable out the shaft and wound it around a razor wire fence post, nobody noticed. It turned out the mines were the perfect place to make radio. At first, Anna's signal was weak, barely even made it past her barracks. But over the years, she scrapped together parts, beefed it up, until she was broadcasting clear to the borders. That's how she made contact with her sisters, Elizabeth and Josie, miners just like her. For a while, the three of them were on the underground at all hours, whenever they had a free moment. They looked out for each other, tracked the movements of the foremen, and planned the big blast that would finally bring down Superior Land. But they waited too long. The foremen caught on to the plan, and when they flooded the mines, Anna was the only sister to escape. After she's finished, I say, "I never even knew there was a signal in Superior Land." "Well," Anna says, "you were an envoy, always guiding visitors or running missions for the foremen." I think she means this as an insult, but she leans in and places a hand on my arm. "You know how that place works," she says. "That's why you're so valuable. That's why I need you." The impact sends both of us flying into the port wall. This hit shakes the caboose even harder than the last, and one of Anna's decorative rocks flies off the dresser and catches me in the temple. Anna and I scramble down to the galley where Beth and Kit and a few others I don't recognize are getting slammed from wall to wall, trying to flip switches and turn valves. I hear a sort of scream from outside the caboose, and I think I recognize the voice. I remember seeing a periscope in the chamber just off the galley. The caboose is rocking hard, but I managed to make my way up to it. At first, I see nothing, just blue light playing off the cave walls. I keep spinning all the way around, and then I see Reed up on an embankment holding a harpoon. When I hear that guttural moan, the same one I heard while sitting up top waiting for Anna, it clicks. The carp. Reed's been baiting it. He brought it here. I'm gonna kill that guy. Beth's up on the ladder, pulling the hatch shut. I start climbing up behind her, and I'm about to tell her to stop and let me out. But then I look at Anna, and she's looking at me. Her eyebrows raised. She's waiting to see what I decide. I make a show of looking at the hatch door one more time. But I already know what I'm going to do. I make myself forget that Reed's up there on the rocks, that Huckins is out in the boat, or maybe even in the water with the carp. And then I step down from the ladder and nod at Anna as the hatch seals shut.
This episode of The River Signal was written and recorded by Galen Huckins, Brian Benson, and Reed Lustig. Audio editing by Jill Schupak. Special thanks to Beth Bambara, Kit Hammond, Bo Jackson, Roy Kasten, Sam A. Mowry, Anna Vodica, Fern and John at Hoppy's Marina, Brandon and the folks at King Marina, Kaskaskia Lock and Dam, Ear Trumpet Labs, and KABU 90.7. For pictures and video of the riverboat trip, and a video of Beth and Kit performing in North St. Louis, check out riversignal.com. Thanks for listening. Stick around for our session with Beth Bambara, and tune in next week for episode 13.
When we first encounter Beth and Kit, they're on a riverfront bike path in North St. Louis, searching for the Channel Princess. The boat is anchored 30 feet from the shore, tied to a forgotten freight dock surrounded by driftwood, lost river buoys, and a runaway fridge. We lead them down a steep mud slope, made passable by the stone staircase Brian just built, then ferry them out to the Channel Princess in our dinghy. Alive with the sounds of rushing water, wind, and industrial river traffic, making the microphone setup an extra challenge. Beth and Kit arrange their instruments, brandishing guitar, violin, and upright bass, with a tambourine and suitcase drum underfoot. As the hum of a passing tug drones off into the distance, the air calms, and Beth and Kit begin to play.
Can you feel the mountain sun? Gonna tell you where to run. Over the hillside, under the blue sky, and it feels good to be alive. And it feels good to be alive. In the shadows, we could barely breathe. I found a light in this dark and weary night. It keeps calling out to me. It keeps calling out to me. It feels good to be alive. feels good to be alive.
You wouldn't guess it from the music that we play these days, but Beth has been kind of a rock and roller up until very recently.
Been in some loud bands.
Yeah. She was in an all-girl punk band for a while. That was pretty awesome.
It was fun. I had moved from Michigan, and then I found myself in St. Louis, surrounded by a completely different musical heritage, different bands that were, you know, a lot more folk Americana oriented. Just through getting to know other musicians and playing with them, it's been, I think, a really natural progression.
I think your music has always had pop sensibility. Even the folk stuff is,
yeah.
There's just, they're pop tunes, just framed in a different way.
Right. Well, I like for people to be able to hear something once that's maybe pretty simple and be able to remember it. That's definitely a quality of pop music. It's kind of a dirty word. Pop music, ooh. Simple melodies and things that are memorable. I mean, I think that's a huge characteristic of folk music too. You could say folk music is a type of pop music.
Silhouette in my review, watch it fade in slow and true. Searching for northwestern sky, 30 days and longer nights. Your eyes are turning red, sleepless nights inside your head. Time don't stop for breaking hearts, went with a thousand miles.
Because I spent a lot of time by Lake Michigan, being around water has really become a way for me to process life. Yeah, a way to understand things. I didn't even notice how much it affected me until I was away from it. You're on the Mississippi River. You can see, you know, how powerful it is. Just experiencing different ways the water can make you feel. Like, it can be really calm and peaceful. It can be really tumultuous and you feel like it's gonna pull you under at points.
Terrifying.
Terrifying, yeah. I could go do that. I could be a fisherwoman. This is my dad's side of the family. They're all discussing, you know, who's gonna take over the fishing boat business, because one of the guys who runs the boat, his three-year-old nephew, he's like the last hope to keep the fishing boats going.
To keep him in the family, at
least. Yeah, to keep him in the family, for sure. So they were like debating, you know, is he gonna want to do this? You know, what's gonna happen to all the boats if he doesn't wanna take care of them and keep them in the family? Jameson, the three-year-old, he's the last hope.
And your face grew cold. Said, I gotta go back home to Ohio. 10 hours on the road. Thoughts spin out of control. We never know when our train is coming to take us home. What can you do with a heavy heart? It'll break you down. It'll remind you who you are. In my younger days, my father tried to explain why I never kissed the face of his own father. He said, just a boy. When my daddy tucked me in one night with next morning's light, he never opened up his eyes again. Heavy heart, it'll break you down, remind you who you are, it'll remind you who
Beth and I write together, or like mostly she will originate ideas and then we'll sort of work them out together.
I usually tend not to write about it more like in a direct way. It's usually more in kind of an abstract way where I'm not telling about certain events that happened in this story. It's more of I'm trying to evoke a certain emotion that was felt in a story or a situation. And I feel like I'm waiting or feeling like what the song is telling me it wants to be.
We've been on tour with different acts and each other, but a lot of it is just like, hey, I'll be there for that show, and then I gotta fly out again. You'll be here for this show, and then you've got another show down the road. So it's a lot of trying to figure out how to have a good relationship while not really being together on a regular basis. That's a weird thing.
Kit was gone on a handful of tours, and I was here in St. Louis, and I've done tours on my own without him, while also like writing an album, so you know, a lot of late night phone calls.
A lot of working on an album together without ever actually being together. It's just like you're trying to accomplish this thing, but with completely imperfect forms of communication that are very like regimented and not always fun to try and work things out that way.
I carry heavy load on my shoulders. Scarce remember when skies were blue. Now the shadows cover everything you do. Masquerading up on that high ground. Is it true? Freedom still rings when the curtain.
So with that, like, we have different ideas when it comes to music. Once we've figured out how to communicate that effectively to each other, the goal is to try to make the best thing possible. You know, so if we're both working towards that same goal, we could do that together without making someone's feelings hurt, you know, by criticizing them or, you know, it's just like we're both working towards the same thing. We've had to learn how to communicate about things in, you know, musical terms. I feel like that's also helped us just improve our overall communication.
If I had a bandage,
As they're putting away their instruments, Beth and Kit tell us that even though they're often apart, touring the country with different bands, they continue to write songs together. Music may be their business, but it's also their passion and an important piece of their relationship. They say that the songwriting process has helped them to strengthen their day-to-day communication. Both are wandering souls, and though we are lucky to catch them this time in St. Louis, who knows where they'll end up in the future? Could be back up on Lake Michigan or deep sea fishing off the eastern seaboard. Almost certainly they'll find themselves by another big body of water. For now, it's back to the dinghy, up the mud slope and into the city. We send them off with fond farewells and a trunk full of our recycling and garbage, and then we pull up anchor and head downstream.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Peña Flamenca de Portland, August 30th at the Headwaters Theater in Portland. This month, La Peña's show features artists from the Bay Area and France, including Andrea La Calena, Cristo Cortez, and Ricardo Diaz y Brenna McDonald. Again, that's Peña Flamenca de Portland, August 30th at the Headwaters Theater, located at 55 Northeast Farragut Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Festicide, a three-day anti-festival taking place in venues all over Portland on August 21st through 23rd. Festicide celebrates Portland's DIY culture with an emphasis on punk, metal, and extreme music. There will be 9 shows across town over the 3-day weekend with performances by Danova, Uncool Niece, Jenny Doe and the Spurs, Rabbits, The Woolen Men, VX Gas Attack, and many, many more. Again, that's Festicide, August 21st through 23rd at venues all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thanks a lot.
On Saturday, August 29th, from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m., the revolutionary music and spirit of Miss Nina Simone will be celebrated by 3 generations of Grassroot News on KBOO Community Radio.
I put a spell on you.